Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Erica Wyatt, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another episode of The Main Course without Patrick Martins on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Alexis McLaughlin. Happy to have Liz Smith engineering in the studio today and excited to be joined by Jeff Mosier and Chris Stillwell, chefs from Robert Mondavi Winery out in Napa, California. Hey guys, thanks for joining.
Hey Alexis, how are you?
How are you doing?
Great, great. I'm really excited to have you on the show. I wanted to jump right in and talk a little bit about this summer concert series that's been going on throughout the summer, and specifically the upcoming next event, which you are using some of our delicious pork products for. Jeff, do you want to tell us a little bit about how the series got started and what people can expect?
Sure. Yeah, so the summer concert series has been going here at Robert Mondavi Winery for just about 40 years. So they've been doing concerts every summer. It's a charity-based event. You know, the money goes to local charities that's raised, you know, beyond the expenses. And it's it was one of the first, you know, big sort of festival-type things in the Napa Valley, and now you see wineries holding concerts, you know, all over the place. And so, you know, a lot of ways, Robert Mondavi Winery sort of started the trend of food and wine being together at the wineries and then adding the music component as well. Where we're at right now is we're sort of in the middle of the concert series. We've got one more next weekend, and we've had a number of fun shows. Chris and I, our end is basically we cook dinner for 300 people before the concert, and then about another 1,200 come and enjoy the show here at the winery. You know, it's a nice, pretty intimate setting, really. It's not very big. You know, everybody's pretty close to the stage, and yeah, it's only about 1,500 people total. So it's a lot of fun, and I mean, on our end, you know, we make dinner, and then we get to see the show too. So we enjoy that part for sure.
I mean, 1,500 people—that's a considerable turnout. 300 to be cooking for before—I'm sure that takes some planning on your part.
Absolutely. It's a lot of logistics. You know, we have a pretty tight team, but it's a fairly small team. You know, it's Chris and I, and about, you know, three or four other people, and then we'll call in, you know, one or two other chefs, you know, on call for our large events and stuff. But we do a family style, so we're sending out, okay, you know, platters of food that are going to, each one's going to be for eight people, so you get a big platter of, you know, panzanella salad or niçoise salad or, you know, lamb with ratatouille or something like that, and we sort of send it out kind of in waves. So it's manageable, but it's always a little tricky, so.
How does the menu planning come about? Is that something that you and Chris work out together? Is it paired at all with the music or any kind of, you know, theme of the event or the summer?
Yeah, good question. We've had a lot of different acts. This is my sixth season here. So I've been here at six or seven. I've been here at the winery for a few years now. And it seems like in the first couple of years that we were here, we had some acts that were like from a certain place, you know, and it kind of made sense, you know, like we had Preservation Hall Jazz Band from New Orleans, or we had, you know, Ziggy Marley, or, you know, somebody who you could kind of say, okay, let's try and do our interpretation of the cuisine of the region that they're from.
Yeah, you can pair it. You can match it and complement it. That's interesting.
Yeah, we do like a jerked quail salad, I think we did when Ziggy was here, and, you know, some, you know, jambalaya or something for Preservation Hall. But, you know, it seems like lately we've had bands that are not so easy to sort of pin to a location. So then we just sort of go into like our summer repertoire, you know, and just go, you know, do things that things that we know we can do well, things that we know are going to show the wines well, and, you know, things that we can execute on that kind of scale.
Wow.
And things that are in season.
Yeah, seasonal, I imagine, especially, you know, out in California and out in Napa is an important component. Another interesting aspect about what you guys do, and I don't know how much of this, you know, you do during the concert series, but you have a beautiful garden at the vineyard and winery that you're pulling from. You guys have a curing program where you're making your own duck prosciutto, your own bacon. How much of that is reserved for, you know, smaller events? And maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, other style, you know, food events that you have at the winery, because it's not a restaurant that would, you know, is open just 7 days a week.
Yeah, we do as much as we can out of the garden and as much as we can out of our little programs where we make duck prosciutto or bacon or other charcuterie type things, and we make our own vinegar now, and we make our own mustards, and we use as much of those things as we can. We use those things to sort of to highlight the food that we're using, but certainly we don't grow enough tomatoes to do 300 people, so we have to come in from, you know, we order from local farms. There's a place that's in between here in Sacramento, there's a local organic farm called River Dog, and they have wonderful produce, and so we buy stuff from them, you know. But we use as much of our own stuff as we can, and then the rest of it, you're right, it's we generally do much smaller parties than 300.
Yeah,
you know, we'll do, and our stuff's usually plated. It's not family style, so we use our own product for a lot of that stuff.
It's like an event-based structure, you know. So we'll have sort of a schedule, a certain number of events in a week. And in the summer and in the fall, it's actually really the busiest in the fall because everybody wants to come when people are making wine. But we'll do, you know, a few hundred people in a week, but it'll be, you know, lunch for 20, dinner for 50, three different lunches for 10 on a day. So we just sort of, we plan out one meal for that shift, and then we make whatever sort of additions or alterations to the menu we need to do based on people's allergies and aversions. So basically, it's sort of just one menu for the day.
How does that keep it interesting? Yeah, you know, having this let's do something different, you know, ability to change the menu and to really do something, you know,
absolutely,
that's, yeah, day to day is different.
Yeah, you can kind of focus on a dish or two. You don't need to sort of constantly be maintaining 15 different items on your menu.
As soon as we don't want to do something, we just change it to what we want to do.
Yeah, a good example would be the tomato miso soup Chris made last night for Amuse. I was kind of skeptical. I was like, I don't know, is that going to work? And, I mean, you can talk about it, but it was awesome.
Chris, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I mean, it was just we made tomato water out of the extra tomatoes that we had from the concert previously.
Well, we know how safe you have to be with water, too, in California right now.
Oh, but it was really just beautiful tomato water. So I just made miso soup out of it like it was dashi, and
Wow.
It came out really nice, you know, and so...
Yeah, no water was used in the soup, so
yeah,
we saved some water.
We fed the water to the tomatoes, and we got it back.
Has that been effective? I mean, I imagine it would have to. Your summer menus and what you guys can offer parties, and is that something like the guests are concerned about as well?
It affects everything, of course, but we've had a couple nice light little rains here, and everything is doing. I was noticing today. I went for a hike before work, and there's just so much more flora and fauna out there than there was last year. Last year it was like desert conditions at this point, and like all the bees were starving. And this year it's much nicer. But we conserve our water. We save all our gray water. We dump all of our water that we have into tanks, and then we water the garden with it. And it's a drop in the bucket, but, you know, whatever, we're trying, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's with solidarity, everyone's, you know, does their part.
It's definitely changed people's practices. You know, there's, like Chris was saying, you know, we try to save all the water that we use to wash vegetables, and, you know, people are just a lot more conscious about how they're cooking and how much water they're using when they're cooking. And, you know, you see a lot more sort of gray lawn or, you know, brown lawns around town, just because people are deciding, you know, making that choice not to use the water for that purpose. But there's not actually rationing going on in Napa at the moment.
But for everybody out there, if you have a lawn, you could have a garden instead of a lawn, and you'd use way less water. Like, you'd use 20% of the water, and you'd have a beautiful garden, and you could have the vegetables out of it and just not have a lawn.
Really? What's the difference? What about a garden requires less water than a lawn?
Oh, my God. You have to water a lawn constantly.
Yeah. Pretend like I'm a layman and that I live in Brooklyn, which I do. Everything's covered in cement.
Well, so we have an irrigation system on our garden out back, and we have like 20 boxes out there, plus fruit trees, plus berries, plus stuff in the ground, and we run a drip system around it, and the drip runs for about half an hour a day. But you walk by somebody's house with a lawn, and it's full on just spraying water into the air, you know, nonstop for like an hour every day. It's a ridiculous amount of water, and you could grow you could rip your lawn out and grow a beautiful garden right in front of your house and use way less water.
Yeah, I guess with the ground cover and the sheer amount of area that's covered that you have to
lawns
water.
Lawns are so wasteful. They're worse than fountains or swimming pools.
Yeah. Never thought about it that way. But that's something that the drought has really brought up, is interesting questions. You know, what is a water-safe menu? And I know other, you know, restaurants and people are beginning to think about, well, what is, you know, what can I eat that impacts better? What kind of wines can I drink that, you know, are, you know, hardier varieties and varietals, just to do your part? And again, it probably is a drop in the bucket, but...
Maybe we should start doing an upcharge for drinking water, for the tap water.
How do you think that would go over?
No, it wouldn't.
You know, one thing that we've actually been talking about, and we've started to do some, is using products that require less water to produce. So, for example, sort of the biggest water user is beef. Cattle. So Chris and I have been, you know, consciously talking about, you know, and trying to use less beef. You know, people still want it, they still request it, but, you know, compared to the amount of water that it takes to raise a squab or a quail or something like that, the amount for cattle is just, you know, it's just way off the charts. Now, we have a great, you know, beef producer that we like, you know, that's local, and, you know, we love their product and we still use it, but, you know, just with the drought in mind, we're doing more sort of vegetable-based menus, more poultry, you know, more smaller fish. You know, it's not the big stuff. So.
Well, you know, I think with the drought in mind as well, it brings up really important points as far as what does local mean? And as wonderful as it is when you have an area that's really abundant and rich in agriculture, you know, maybe when you see a drought, it's not the place to be raising livestock.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that can be a hard conversation in California, because local is such an important point and such an important driving factor in the agricultural business. But when is it okay to say, you know, there are other areas that are well irrigated that don't have these drought issues that are better suited for raising livestock?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that we get from you guys is a good example of that for sure. You know, the Berkshire pork that we get from you, we get because it's the best we can find. You know, it's our favorite. It's been our favorite for years, and we know that most of it's coming from Missouri, but we can get nice pork from here in California, but again, you know, the water thing, and it's also just about the quality. You know, we love the stuff from Heritage.
Oh, thank you. And I have to clarify, the radio is not sending you guys pork. The Heritage Foods USA, where I spend my day job, talking to you guys. But thank you so much. That's awesome. But it's true, you know, out in Kansas, they're seeing, you know, tons of rain. They're just, you know, mm-hmm. being flooded this season, and they have, you know, the fertile prairie land, you know, prairie grass and pasture areas and rain to support and sustain these livestock. So it's, you got to get it where you can find it.
Yeah, for sure.
Chris, what about your bees? How are they faring?
They're doing really good, actually. My bees are strong. We found the queen today. It was a beautiful thing.
Did you lose her? Was she lost before?
But so, you know, when there's 60,000 of them in a box, it's hard to pick out one, you know?
Fair enough.
But yeah, we went through the entire hive today, and everybody looks good. Everybody looks happy. They're laying eggs, and they're doing great. You know, I killed a hive beetle, which is kind of a bummer.
What are hive beetles? What do they do?
Hive beetle is the new threat. You know, there's the varroa, and everybody knows about the varroa, the little mites that are, you know, they're like little ticks that suck the juice out of the larva when they're growing up. But the new one's a hive beetle, and we killed one, so I got them. But my stock is strong, and our genetics are strong, and we just resist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the hive stays strong, and, you know, whatever varroa or high beetle that you got, my genetics are strong enough to overcome all that. So. They're doing very well, and they've had a good year. It's been, like I said, we got a couple nice light summer rains here and a couple late rains in May. Last year it stopped raining early February and didn't rain again until next February. It was horrible, till December, really, but it was pretty bad. It was to the point where, you know, there was just nothing blooming for months and months.
What do you say they're really helping out the garden? It's been, what, 2 years now we've had the bees?
3 years. This is our third year.
Three.
Yeah.
And you noticed it in the garden?
Yeah, they pollinate everything in the garden. You know, the native pollinators, we have those as well. You know, the bumblebees and the little native scrawny-looking little bees. And they just don't do it on the level that the honeybees do. You know, and our garden went from literally the year we put the bees in, our garden just exploded.
Chris, you were telling me a little bit earlier about some hive maintenance that you were doing. What is, I don't understand, you took the hive apart and put it back together?
Right. So, I mean, a hive, there's nothing that holds the hive together. So it's a box that has no top and no bottom, and then there's frames that sit into it, and then you put it on top of a base that's a screen, then you put another box on top of that the same way with no top and no bottom, and you put the frames in, and then you put a little thin lid on it, and nothing holds it together, and then you put a cap on the top, and then the bees go in, and they glue it all together with this stuff called propolis, and it's this tacky polymer that they make out of tree sap, mostly conifer sap, that they collect as well. As they not only collect honey and nectar and pollen, but they collect this propolis, and they make it into this really super tacky, hard polymer, and they just glue everything together with it. They plug every little hole, and they fill every little space. And if the space isn't big enough to build comb there, they fill it with propolis. And so you go through and you remove all the burr comb where they build comb where you don't want it to, and you remove all the propolis and just put it back to, you know, you take the thing apart, look at it, look at what's going on in your...
Are you inspecting for general health of the hive and just to see, you know...
Yeah, you know, well, if there's anything wrong, this is getting late in the year to fix it, you know, because if there's something wrong, you can fix it. You know, there's an answer to just about everything, but if you're not in there finding it out, then you can't fix it.
Yeah.
But everything looked really good. We found one diseased bee. That was it.
And the queen. And you found
the queen. We only found one bee that was diseased. So out of, you know, 60,000 bees, we have one sick one.
60,000, give or take. That's a good percentage.
Yeah, good ratio.
I'll take those numbers.
Yeah.
Awesome. How much do you, and you use the honey? Because like you said, they're honeybees, so you're using the honey in the kitchen. Everything is coming together.
We took a couple liters out in like February or March, and we still have probably... 2 pints of it or something.
I have to imagine you're probably partial to your own honey now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm stingy with it as well.
Jeff is laughing and agreeing with us.
Yeah, I agree for sure. We try to hold on to it, you know, use it for special occasions because, you know, like you said, there's not that much. You know, it's not the kind of thing we would use for one of the giant parties, one of the 300-person parties or something. You know, a lot of the garden stuff we pull out for little groups. We do one program, you know, every Thursday from May through October called the Garden to Table program where people, they just sign up for it online or here at the winery, and they come at 4 o'clock and we go out into the garden and we pick a bunch of vegetables and show them the beehives and we show them sort of the unusual things we have in the garden. You know, our sort of philosophy with this garden here is it's not huge. So as Chris was saying, you know, we couldn't grow all the tomatoes we would need for a concert, but we try to grow things that are either, you know, hard to obtain or expensive or best, like, really fresh. So, for example, like some of the limes, like we have a Kaffir lime tree, so you'd want to just go out and be able to pick a lime leaf and throw it into your soup or your broth or whatever and not, you know, not have to buy them. Usually when you buy them, they're not in very good condition. They come frozen. You have to buy a pound. So, you know, we have a lot of things like that. You know, we have lemongrass, lemon verbena. We have a finger lime tree, so we like to show people that because that's a fun one.
I know what they are, but can you explain it for the folks listening? Because it's pretty,
sure.
It's
so
pretty cool.
It basically grows these pods that are, you know, sort of elongated, about the size of a finger, and you cut them open, and there are these little beads inside that are The best way to describe it is sort of like a citrus caviar. You know, they kind of pop in your mouth, and they've got a real sort of bright citrus flavor. You can, you know, put them on fish or desserts. You know, you could sort of candy them or something like that for a dessert.
And they're kind of free, right? They're not like sectioned off?
Sorry?
They're kind of free. They're not really sectioned off inside the lime, so they just kind of spill out like eggs, like roe.
Inside of an orange, but they're round and they're full of this finger lime juice, which tastes limeish, but it's also got kind of a caviar lime flavor to it as well.
Yeah,
it's great as like a vegan caviar too. You know, that's what I would describe it as. It's like a citrus vegan caviar.
Yeah, it's pretty
cool.
Keep
in mind, we have no gardener, by the way. So, you know, when I say we couldn't grow the tomatoes for the
concert,
don't
say that, Chris.
We could.
You are the gardener. You and Jeff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
If someone wants to, can you tell us where to find out with some more information about the summer series? If someone is interested in going, how would they?
Yeah, sure.
Are there tickets?
So you can get. I think tickets are still available for the last show, both you know, the lawn tickets and the tickets. I think there's a few tickets left for the dinner in the back, and you can find them on the Robert Mondavi Winery website. So people couldn't just go there, or if you're in, you know, you're in the area, you can just come to the winery and just talk to the people at the front at guest relations, and you know, sign up for any of the programs that are available. You know, in addition to the Garden to Table one, we do on Thursday nights. We do a program called the Harvest of Joy, 3 days a week: Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. It's a lunch, and it's you know, like we said, it's not a restaurant. It's sort of like a, you know, like an event-based thing or an appointment-only restaurant. So you make an appointment, you come, you get like a tour of the winery, and then you have a meal where everything's paired with a different wine. And you can sign up for those online or here at the winery. And yeah, concert tickets still available. The last one is Trombone Shorty and New Orleans Band. Should be awesome. I saw him once a couple years ago at the Greek in Berkeley, and it was a really fun show. You know, it's kind of like lively modern jazz, I guess. He rolls with a fairly sizable band, and yeah, he just rips it on that trombone. It's pretty fun.
Awesome. It sounds like it's going to be a blast. I want to say thank you, Chef Jeff Mosier and Chef Chris Stillwell, for taking the time and talking with us
sure.
a little bit more. I'm really excited. I hope I'll hear about the concert event from you guys after. And then now we're going to go to a quick break, and we will be back with farmer Frank Reese.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to the main course. I am Alexis McLaughlin, excited to have Patrick Martin's the man himself in studio.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Frank Reese, renowned poultry farmer, on the line with us as well. Thank you, Frank.
Godfather of American poultry. The undisputed king or queen of poultry. And it is really, really impressive what you've done for biodiversity in America just on your own farm. So we're calling you about this Good Shepherd Institute, which will provide hands-on and lecture-style training. And it'll cover basically so many topics related to what you do. Breeder selection, reproduction for good marketability, biodiversity, strong genetics, welfare, economics behind farming, marketing, land and environmental issues, housing at all levels of animal production, and of course processing and transportation. So what inspired you to commit to trying to launch the Good Shepherd Institute, Frank?
The main reason was is I wanted to be able to pass on the knowledge that I was taught. But even more important than that, practical poultry farming, as it used to be taught at universities, has been completely dismantled, does not exist anymore. So I wanted to start a bachelor's degree program, again, that would focus on developing poultry scientists for leadership for the next generation. I'm hoping the institute, which will have multiple purposes, it can be very small individual groups and teaching, but the bigger picture is to train the leaders for the next generation so that the knowledge that used to be quite common can be brought back again.
So can you talk to us about how you met with the people of Wesleyan University in Salina and the process by which you're developing the curriculum for it to be part of their bachelor's program?
Sure. Ann Knowles, who used to be the dean of one of the colleges here locally, called me, and she is on the Board of Regency for Kansas Wesleyan University. And Ann has been a very outspoken proponent and believer in my work, and she knew that I was trying to find some way of reestablishing an academic program for sustainable farming. Well, Kansas Wesleyan, just this last year for the first time, has now started a four-year degree program in environmental issues and sustainability, and they wanted to expand into agriculture. And so as Ann said, well, we've got the perfect farm, the perfect person to do this. And so Ann came to me, and I have met with the president and various deans of the college, and we have signed an agreement to begin this work on developing a livestock program. And Kansas Wesleyan also, in this program, is going to focus on specifically heritage breeds. We're starting with poultry, but we're hoping eventually this will expand into dairy and to pork and to lamb. This is going to take a long time, but at least we're getting started and the people are starting the discussions.
So, one last question for me. So you've started a 501c3 nonprofit called the Good Shepherd Institute, GSI, and you're looking to raise money. And can you tell our listeners where that money is going and, you know, where you would like to see your farm in 3 or 5 years as it relates to the institute?
The money will go basically in two separate ways. One of the ways in which the money will go will be to build the curriculum and get that started. And then at that point, Kansas Wesleyan will be able to raise its own money. Mm-hmm. The rest of the money will be going to build what I call the brick and mortar, the actual buildings that we so desperately need to be able to bring students here and start them on their career program. We need places within the institute which they can use to have on hands. You know, I could bring 500 barred rock roosters in and put them up in cages and proceed to teach the students how to pick the best rooster out of the flock. But also, it could be more than that. You know, we also need to build a place, you know, where we can teach cooking, culinary, things like this. And then, you know, because I get attention from all around the world, we're also hoping to have teleconferencing where we can actually bring people in from China or from Africa or from South America, and through virtual telecom, they'll be able to take part in the lectures and deal with their local problems.
Frank, what about opportunities for someone who is interested in these kind of farming practices and heritage breeds but is not seeking a bachelor degree?
that's why we need to teach leaders. You know, trying to teach one person on a weekend is very, very, very limited. I think it's nice that they want to come, and I think we need to do those sort of things, and we can expose to them on a very short basis. But to try to teach poultry husbandry in the full sense takes a long time, because it's, you know, there's so many components.
Absolutely.
But so what we're hoping to do is to teach the leaders, who then will go back and set up co-ops all across this country.
And
they
of course,
will become the county extension agents that we used to have.
And it'll be your genetics.
And spread this and help many farmers. Mm-hmm. And because it isn't just raising the chickens, it's setting up the entire infrastructure that it takes to support this, whether it be processing plant or trucking or packaging or understanding rules and regulations. And the other huge component that's so missing is the breeder farms, the hatcheries that are producing quality heritage poultry. And how do you maintain that? How do you design nutrition? How do you handle disease? How do you handle biosecurity? You can't learn that on a two-day weekend. Now, you can learn. What we're hoping is that those people who want to come here for two or three days, what they're coming to do is to learn what this is about, to meet the students, to see the birds, to be supporters, to say, you know, hey, this is really important. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we want the doors to the Institute to be open, have nothing to hide.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
For people to come and see what's happening.
Well, it's interesting.
And then the other component of is the chefs, the cooks. Whether they're for your home use, or if you're trying to supply quality high-end chicken meat for an entire school, that those people can come here and see what our students are doing and how they're helping many, many farmers across the United States. Most farmers are too busy to come and get a degree.
Well, Frank,
so instead of having those people, we want to set up those leaders who will go back to whether it's to California, Arizona, Montana, Vermont, wherever, and be able to reach out and help many farmers, set up co-op offices, set up those systems that support this type of farming.
So, Frank, I wanted to say, you know, just to conclude, I mean, there is a tour date, September 16th to 20th. Future dates after that will be announced. It's 4 nights and 4 days, basically living and working at your farm and staying at a lovely hotel. People can go to the Heritage Foods USA website for more information. And it is a multifaceted approach. You're also were a subject in Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals, which is now becoming a movie that was picked up by the actress whose name is going to escape.
Natalie Portman.
Natalie Portman, yeah.
Which I applaud her for making a movie on such a subject. And just finally to conclude, you know, in your efforts to kind of educate and change the world and make it a better place, I mean, your genetics, every time Frank sees a chicken, he's like, that's not a real Barred Rock or that's not a real Narragansett. It frustrates him that people, you know, are kind of sadly raising things that they think to be true, and then they're like, but it only grew to be 8 to 10 pounds. It was supposed to be 20 to 22 pounds, and it's because it's not those right genetics. So the more Frank gets the word out, be it through these short format weekends or through the university or through the movies, you know, through TV shows, you know, it's just an important cause, biodiversity for livestock. So, well, thanks so much. Did you have one last thing, Alexis? All right. Well, thanks for listening, and thanks, Frank, for being on, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you both.